Thank you, Eric, and good morning to you early listeners. We have another visitor in the studio this morning whose interest in the fashionable world is worthy of our attention. Ms. Myrtle Finer, a newcomer to Fairbanks, is here on a sightseeing tour of the Northland before returning to her home in Milwaukee. Myrtle, as I understand it, you have just returned from a buying trip to that glamorous center of fashion, New York, where you were buying for your shop in Milwaukee. Since you're just fresh from the big town, perhaps you can convey some of the more vivid impressions to our listeners, particularly about what is being worn. You know, we've heard so many reports, and now we'd like to have the final word from one who has seen all. Now, what would you say, Myrtle, is the most significant change in the style picture this year?
There are so many radical changes in the fashion field for this coming fall. However, I do feel the most important one would be the length.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what is the average length of skirts from the floor now?
The average, perhaps, would be about 14 inches. However, it does vary from 12 to 15, depending upon your own stature and your personality and your makeup. I would still suggest to wear the length that is most becoming to you.
Well, I second the motion on that. Now, Myrtle, do you think that this style will become an accepted thing among fashionable women? You know, many women I know have expressed the feeling that the longer skirts are strictly a fad and will go out like so many other fads. How well do you feel they're being accepted in various parts of the states?
Well, I'm definitely of the opinion that it's not a fad. Certainly it is being accepted universally. Some sections are a little bit more reluctant about taking it on for the time being. But in New York, they have accepted them, and even in the Midwestern sections, we are wearing our skirts longer. Somebody only yesterday, one of your Fairbanks women, asked me if it was being accepted in California, because that apparently is her home state. Well, I might add that in California, they are wearing them longer than any place else in the United States.
Well, now that is an interesting note, because this spring, when I was speaking about the average length of skirts, I did note that the distance from New York seemed to make a difference in women's willingness to accept the longer length. I understood in the spring that New Yorkers were willing to accept it, but other people wouldn't. So I see that the new skirts are becoming the thing if everyone else is taking it on.
That certainly is going to be the case, I'm sure.
Well, do you feel that there are other important changes particularly noteworthy in the New York fashion picture?
Well, the full sweep in garments, especially coats, is very noteworthy. Since the restriction L85 has been lifted and the designers are able to use their ingenuity again, they are using it to the utmost. You will find, too, that they are putting jumbo pockets on coats, whether they are fur-trimmed or untrimmed, and using the large Puritan collars, which are very interesting. And then, too, we are showing some fur-trimmed suits that are new. We haven't had them for several seasons. They offer any number of types, both in the box jacket and in the fitted type with the long torso lines, small collars out of fur with pockets out of fur. They're extremely interesting. I'm sure that they're going to be accepted very well.
Well, it certainly does sound as though designers are using their ingenuity, and after the war years and the lean years of no fashion and rather dogmatic styling, I think we're very happy to see the return of personality in fashion. Now, did you see anything that you thought was particularly interesting?
Well, we have seen on our last trip most of the preliminary showings of all the better houses. The Belciano numbers, which I am sure all of you have seen in all the magazines, are most interesting. We had one number that had a complete yoke of beaver and large jumbo pockets with the contrasting fabric woven in the yoke of the fur.
Interesting.
It was very interesting. And the same manufacturer also used the same theme, but used a contrasting fabric in a buckle treatment for both the collar and on the large jumbo pocket.
Sounds like a wonderful idea. I can't wait to see them myself.
They're simply gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you mention something about Jap mink also being a popular fur this year?
Yes, Jap mink is coming into its own. We haven't seen it for several years, as well as beaver. Now, beaver has been prohibitive in price, of course, so it has not been on the market to any great extent. This year, it is used very lavishly and very well. The treatments are very interesting.
Well, I think much can be done with Jap mink, and I'm very glad myself to see it back again. I remember years ago in my mother's clothes that it was used very handsomely. Now, do you think that suits are going to hold their own in popularity this year. You mentioned the fur-trimmed suit. Do you think that suits as a whole are going to stay in?
I'm sure that they have. I feel that suits have won a particular niche for themselves in the fashion picture, and I don't believe that they are stereotyped any longer. In past years, many times, the suits were simply a classic, and of course, we would become very tired of them, and we would want to have a few interesting dresses in our wardrobe. Mm-hmm. However, I do feel that the women today have become very suit-minded and realize that no matter where they are always well-groomed in a suit. The designers, too, have realized the importance of the suits in the woman's wardrobe and are using their ingenuity. The pencil-slim skirts with the side closings on jackets are very interesting for this season. They are using the box jacket again with the pencil slim skirt mm-hmm. with fur trims on them. And fabrics also are playing an important part in the suit picture. Forsman has developed a broadcloth that adapts itself very beautifully for a fur-trimmed suit.
Well, that does sound wonderful. Now, are the gabardines going to still hold good? We've had them for a long time, but I still think it's a worthwhile fabric.
I believe that gabardine is still a top fabric.
Mm-hmm.
We are showing some of the worsted fabrics and the menswear types, shark skins, bird's eyes, and so forth, and they're manipulated very well. They really are beautiful, but gabardine still is number one.
In other words, then you'd say that a suit, instead of taking the place of a dress, is a definite picture in itself. It's a definite
That's
fashion
true.
Feature to count on at any time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke about the new fabrics coming in. Do you find that these fabrics are being used in unusual colors, or are they sticking to the more conservative tones that they've used in the past?
No, the colors are very interesting this season. The wine tones and the deep greens especially are getting back. And the browns, too, have been out of the picture for a number of seasons. The browns, we find, are coming in very strong this season. The Forsman has developed his colors in the tapestry tone field and is using the Arras and the Veronese green and the Beauvais red, which are very smart. Of course, black is always good. We know that.
Yes, yes. Black is always good
That's
at
right.
any time. And I was interested in knowing that, hearing you mention that designers were dipping back into the past for colors, and you mentioned several Italian cities famous for their colors in painting in the during the Renaissance period. We mentioned that just previously, that designers were dipping back
that's
into
right.
history for color and design, and I think that's a very vital thing
I
this year.
I think so, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we're on the subject of color, what do you think about dark hose? I understand that there's a radical change coming up in the color of hose this season, as well as in the length of the skirts.
Yes, the dark hose are coming in, and they're very smart. You will find that it makes a costume look complete. If you are wearing a beige suit, for instance, and are having the dark brown accessories with it, keep your hose in the dark brown also, because it's very smart.
Also remembering, of course, that the hose must be perfectly sheer. In other words, very fine
Definitely.
Sheer hose. They're the only type that can be worn with it in the darker tones.
Definitely, because they would look way too heavy if you kept them in the heavier gauge.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, isn't it true that in the darker tones, the hose has a tendency to slim the leg and give it a much longer, finer appearance?
Well, that most certainly is true, because I'm sure that we're all aware of what a white stocking will do to your leg.
That's true.
Yes.
I think that's a very interesting
that's
point
right.
of contrast. Of course, Myrtle, you've only been in Fairbanks now for only 2 days, but as far as fashion here is concerned, I think you may have registered some impressions of style consciousness in Alaska, or shall I say Fairbanks?
Well, I think you'd better leave it Fairbanks, because Fairbanks is the first large city that mm-hmm. I've gone into, and I'm sure the small ones that I've gone through are not style conscious.
Well, probably not as representative.
No, definitely not. But I did find that in Fairbanks, and visiting your shops, that they carried very fine merchandise, well-known names in the fashion world, and I also noticed that your Fairbanks women are very well-dressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for
yes.
the compliment, mm-hmm. and it's very interesting to note that one who has been all over the United States and who certainly has been on many buying trips to New York considers Fairbanks women well-dressed. Now, I might ask, just as a little sourdough footnote, did you do anything else while you were here except notice the length of our skirts?
Yes, indeed, I did. I came up here with two other girls from Milwaukee, and we have been doing just everything that's possible to do in 24 hours of the day, because that's actually what you have here is 24 hours a day. It seems very unusual for us to be able to do things at 12, 1 o'clock at night that normally we would have to certainly do in the daytime. We went out the other day to pan some gold.
Oh, how interesting.
And the men out there, Nick and John, were very kind and gave us some nuggets.
That was around Live and Good, wasn't it?
Yes, it was near Live and Good. Mm-hmm. Of course, the dust, I must say, we couldn't leave unnoticed because that was very prominent. But we've enjoyed our stay immensely.
Well, we're very happy to know that you did enjoy your stay, Miss Myrtle Finer, and it was a pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Thank you.
And good morning.
Seven 7:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel on 2nd Avenue, and their telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 10A. We have this week as a visitor on Here's a Pioneer a distinguished old-timer named Harry Carstens, and I feel sure that Harry is so well known to hundreds of our listeners tonight. Carstens, I think, will be remembered best as one of the leaders of the Carstens Stuck Expedition, the expedition that climbed to Mount McKinley, to the very peak. Now, Mr. Carstens, I'm going to retrace your story in connection with Alaska by first asking, what was your home in the States?
Chicago was my home.
Your home was Chicago, and what year did you come to Alaska?
1897.
What was it that made you decide to come north?
Well, there was a fellow named Windy Bill came down into Montana, and I heard him talking in a restaurant of the big excitement in Dawson. He had just left there and told of the big strike and so forth, and that made me decide to start the north.
You finally decided to come north.
Yeah.
What was your taking off place? Where did you start doing your walking when you finally got to Alaska? Dyea.
Started over out from Dyea. We had very little. There was a young fellow with me. We had very little money or supplies, so we packed for other people over the scales towards Lindeman, and acquired quite a little food that way.
Over the pass in July of 1897.
That was in July, August, way going into August or. In August.
At least in
September.
The summer of 1897.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went down to Lake Lindeman, and eventually you moved on down to Dawson. Is that
built correct? A boat at Lindeman, whipsawed lumber and built a boat.
Did you have a pretty easy trip down to Dawson?
Well, it was rather rough on the lakes. Mm-hmm. Had considerable trouble. But before we got to Dawson, we run into ice. We had quite a time getting through at White River. Landed in Dawson on November 1st. And the following morning, the river closed and our boat was gone.
Oh.
But we were ashore.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you made out all right anyway. Now, did you get as rich, Harry, in Dawson as you expected to?
Oh, no. In the first place, provisions were pretty scarce and high. Mm-hmm. Flour was $125 a sack. Milk was $2.50 a can. Butter was $5 a pound, and you couldn't buy any. I did get some, though, for old-time prices from Schutz of the NAT Company. Mm-hmm. He gave me a small supply of stuff at old-time prices, and I was mighty lucky. It helped me out that winter a whole lot.
How long did you stay there in Dawson in 97?
I stayed there until latter end of February. Mm-hmm. I had tried to record some claims on Skookum Hill, but couldn't do it. So I took on downriver.
Where did you go after you left Dawson?
I went down to Mission Creek. There was a number of other fellows there, and we laid out Eagle City, stampeded on the creeks there and staked a few claims, then went on down to 70 Mile and staked a number of claims there, and then returned to Dawson.
I understand that you spent a lot of time hauling the mail to Valdez via dog sled, didn't you?
Yes, I took the first mails out of Eagle towards Valdez.
How many miles was that?
My run was about 250 miles.
Mm-hmm. Was it particularly tough? What time of the year were you making that run?
In the fall. Mm-hmm. I had a tremendously tough trip. I was a young fellow. Had never had much experience in the hills. Did a lot of river work. But I had to find my way over in the 40-mile country, steel quick, up the Mosquito Fork, and over into Tanana Crossing. Mm-hmm. And there I met people from the south, fellows from the south with the mail return mail. Then back again, I got down as far as Steel Creek, and the river was closed down below. I couldn't go around by the mouth, so I had to go across country. I had dogs, but the sleigh couldn't handle a sleigh, and there happened to be an old cowhide. I rigged up the cowhide with the mail in each end and a little space in the center for grub. Uh-huh. And made a toboggan out of it.
It worked pretty good.
The hair sloping backwards. Mm-hmm. I hooked the dogs onto that, and it worked fine.
Oh, well, good. Understand that you eventually drifted into Fairbanks. What was Fairbanks like in 1903?
Well, there was quite a little town here in 1903. A number of... but there was no money here then. Uh-huh. There was no... gold mines, only Pedro had a very low grade ground.
You suppose there was about a dozen buildings here then?
Oh, more than that. Mm-hmm. There was quite a big town here.
Uh-huh. When did you make a trip for the biological survey?
That was with Charles Sheldon.
Oh, yes.
Of New York and Washington. He was a hunter, big game hunter, and doing a good deal of his work for the biological survey, mm-hmm. scientific work. Getting all mammals and birds and all records. And I took him the first year, I took him into the McKinley Range. We were in there 4 months during the summer of '07. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, he had an idea that it would be a good thing to have that as a sanctuary, game sanctuary and a park. So after that trip, he telegraphed me the following year and came in and stayed a whole year. Mm-hmm. And we got all the data we could in regard to game and scenic, traveled all over the area with horses in summer and dogs in winter. And from that time, that was 1908, until 17, he tried to get that passed and eventually did in 1917.
You fellows then were actually laying plans for Mount McKinley National Park, weren't you?
Yes.
And didn't you serve as the first superintendent of the park?
Yes. He asked me if I didn't want the position. I told him sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, too, that your travels with Sheldon gave you the background for your eventual trip up Mount McKinley. Isn't that true?
More or less. He asked me at the time if I'd go with him, mm-hmm. if he'd make the ascent. I told him, sure, I'd take a chance. But he got married when he went outside, and that spoiled it.
And that gave up his part in the expedition. Then you eventually decided to combine your efforts with Archdeacon Hudson Stuck, isn't that correct?
Well, Hudson Stuck was after me for a number of years to make that trip to the mountain, to make the climb. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel as though I could afford to do it. I had to make a living, and I was more or less chasing around the country. But I eventually did. In 1912, I promised him to go. It was a joint undertaking, which he states in his letters, which I have. And we were to share in the book and the articles and so forth. We started in the summer of 12. I took the provisions and stuff we needed mostly in by boat as close as I could to the mountain up the Bear Paw. Then in the spring, in about March, he came in and we got three dog teams together. There was Tatum, one of the mission boys, 20 years old, and Walter Harper, 20 years old. They were, and Deacon and myself were the ones that made the climb. There was 2 15-year-old Indian boys that were along to help do the work. We went in March with the dog teams, picked up the stuff from where I'd cached it at the head of the Bear Paw, and freighted it in to the base of the mountain. That is on Willow Creek, at the foot of McGonigal Pass, which leads onto the Muldrow Glacier at about, I should judge, about 5,000 feet.
Uh-huh.
Well, from there, we used dogs to 11,500 of the Rand Basin. We had double-tripped it, or a number of trips up there with the dogs, and had a good supply of stuff, had silk tents, and quite a little mountain grub and equipment. And the last trip, we took up the big tent and set it up and used wood. We hauled wood up there. But in the last trip up, the got nearer to where the cache was, we smelled smoke. And the we're rushing forward, you found the cache was afire.
I imagine that you figured that fire would be the last thing you'd have to worry about up there.
I see. We never realized, couldn't think that it would be a fire, but in some way it caught a fire. Mm-hmm. Our silk tents were all burned up, and our clothing, most of it, mitts and so forth, and a lot of stuff. Well, the deacon thought we were ruined, but we went through the stuff we had that was left and managed to salvage a lot. I sent a couple of the boys down to the base camp to get the canvases, sleigh canvases, and for 3 weeks, between storm and working, we made socks, mitts, and I built a tent.
I imagine then that you were pretty well equipped again when you decided to keep going up.
Yes, we were fairly well equipped. We had quite a lot of kerosene, plenty. We had plenty of provisions, but it was principally we were shy on the mitts and stockings and so forth, mm-hmm. that were burned up, you know.
How did the rest of the trip go now?
Well, it was a matter, it wasn't such a difficult thing, except for the northeast ridge, which is called the Carson Ridge. That is the most difficult climb or different part of the whole climb. The after Herschel Parker was up on the mountain and got within 500 feet of the top, they had to come down on account of a strong wind up there, where if they'd gone any further, it would have blown them off. Also, they were short of grub. They came down, and that night, when they got down, there was a big earthquake. Shook the whole mountain. And it shattered the Carson Ridge at the lower end, broke off, and went down into the valley, thousands of feet on either side. That left a cleavage of about 50 foot of ice, halfway up the ridge, which is at an angle of about 45 degrees. And that had to be worked around. Mm-hmm. Well, that was some difficult. You want to go?
And how did you find the top of the mountain itself? Were you pretty well tired out by the time you got up there?
Well, it was. It wasn't exactly tired. It was merely that the exertion was great, breathing. You'd go a few hundred steps and you'd be breathing, panting, trying to get breath.
I see.
But we found out that while sitting down, before getting up, keep a panting hard and then get up and walk, you go a good deal further.
Mm-hmm.
Get a lot of oxygen, it seems, into the lungs. And
now, I'd like to know about the very moment when you ascended the top of the mountain. Who was the first of your party? I understand there were four of you who finally did get to the top. Who was the first?
Well, a great deal of the time I kept Walter Harper in the lead. And going up, I thought it was no more than fair to leave him there. So he was the first one to be on top.
I see. Walter Harper, 20-year-old native boy. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you made a rather quick trip down, didn't you?
Yes, it was only a 2-day trip down. Mm-hmm. That was because of willowing the lower glacier around all the crevasses and building bridges, snow bridges across the crevasses.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harry, our time is up now, and we'll have to call it quits on this interview. I feel that I could spend hours with you and would certainly enjoy it, talking about your adventures, especially in connection with Mount McKinley. Friends, we've listened to an interview with Mr. Harry Karstens, one of the partners of the Karstens Stuck Expedition, which climbed Mount McKinley. And what year did you say that was, Harry?
1913.
Well, thank you ever so much, Harry Karstens. Friends, you've listened to Here's a Pioneer, brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company, each Wednesday evening at 7:30. The Pioneer Cab Company, located across from the Nordale Hotel. You may telephone anytime, East 10A. Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, brought to you every week at this time. The Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Coble, is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number around the clock is East 10A. This week's distinguished visitor to Here's a Pioneer is a member of the Explorers Club. He's a real old-time Alaskan and is now associated with the Aleutian Islands. His name is Jack McCord, a name that I believe is familiar to many of our listeners. Jack, first of all, I'm going to ask of you something in regard to what was your home down in the States and whatever made you come to the North.
Well, I lived in Iowa. I was born in Iowa, in the southern part of that state. And why I come North, I could hardly say, except I'm like a cow in the pasture. When I got started, I want to go to the end of the pasture.
And what ship did you come to Alaska on?
I left Seattle in 1906 and came to Alaska on the old steamer Yucatan. It was then belonged to the Northwest Steamship Company, which is now the Alaska Steamship Company.
I see. And what port did you first see in Alaska?
I never saw land until I came to Kayak Point, out 17 miles outside of Katella in Controller Bay. And we came into that port, if you might want to call it a port. There was no harbor there.
Well, I'm interested in what kind of adventures you might have first met when you came to the territory. What about those first few months? How did you get your foothold in Alaska?
Well, I came steerage to Alaska, and I was going to work in the Elmar copper mine. But when I was on this boat steerage coming north, there was a stowaway came out of the boat and told me I shouldn't go there, that there was a strike there, and that I would be a scab. So he induced me to get off with him at this port of Katella, where they were going to build a railroad into the interior, to the copper mines and to the coal mines, up Bering River and the Copper River.
And what sort of employment did you take when you got there?
Well, I wasn't employed, naturally, so I asked to go to work, and they put me on a checker and on a survey party. They were surveying the railroad and surveying the land around about, so they put me on the survey party and also checking material from the boats that stood out in the roadstead. There was no harbor.
I see. And did you have any adventures in connection with the railroad up there? I understand there was a little keen competition.
Well, there was another railroad, I wouldn't say a railroad, but a promoter from Chicago saw fit to get in the way of this railroad that was going to be built to the Kennecott copper mines, and so that he could ask a considerable sum for his right-of-way, and he did, and caused a little skirmish there that lasted 3 or 4 days.
Were there any bruised or broken heads?
Well, there was one fella shot and wasn't injured much, and one man from Dawson had his head bruised up considerable, and there was quite a little conflict there for several days.
I see. Now, what did you do after you left the copper country there? Will you go on with your travels?
I went to Valdez and came over the trail, and I walked over that trail, and you know, when I think about this sign out here at the end of the road, I don't know whether it's here yet or not, Al, but there used to be a sign out here at the end of the road that says 460 miles to Valdez, and I look at that sign in those wintry days. I remembered always when I hoofed it in over that trail and walked fast past the roadhouses that were high priced in the middle.
You knew the trail then when it was nothing more than a moose pass.
Yeah, just a trail. We come over double enders and dog teams and traveled on foot.
What did you do when you got up in the interior?
Well, I wanted to prospect, of course, and I got me a cabin over here in Grail across the slough, and a prospecting partner took me out over on Fish Creek to sink a hole, a tributary of Fish Creek they called Solo Creek. And we pulled our sled out there by hand and sank two or three holes on Solo Creek.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you found some pretty big nuggets over there.
No, not on Solo Creek.
Not on Solo Creek.
No, oh, we found nothing. That is as it should be.
Uh-huh. Well, where was it that you found the second largest nugget ever located in the territory?
That is in the Koyukuk on Hammond River. Some years after that, in about 1910, I went to Circle City and to Fort Yukon and the Chandelier, walking, of course, and with dogs part the way, and went over into the Koyukuk. And in that camp, I was later joined by Mr. Kinney from Ester Creek, and our company took out on four above Hammond River about $107,000. And one nugget was the second largest found in Alaska. It brought about $2,600 at the old price of gold.
I understand that you have a special fondness, even yet, for the Koyukuk country.
Yes, I love that north country in the Arctic, and it seems to appeal to every prospector. It's an unexplored country to a great extent, and there's some wonderful men that come into that country in the early days, and you like to associate with them and like to talk with them even today and have memories with them.
I imagine, then, that you have still many old friends over in that country. Are you going to visit them?
I visit them every year, most every year, and I'll visit them this year again in August. I visited them twice last year. I always will.
Well, now we're changing the subject, Jack. What was it during the course of your life that centered your attention on the Aleutian Islands?
Well, I would hardly call this Aleutian Islands. Aleutian Islands are out under the Bering Sea, and I'm in the district adjacent to Kodiak, which is not in the Aleutian Islands. It's underneath the Alaskan Peninsula in the Japan Current. And I consider that a better place than the Aleutian Islands for the reason that it's free from those fogs and cold winds off the Bering Sea. It's protected by the mainland, and it's also affected by the Japanese Current.
Well, who was it that first told you about that country, that made it appeal to you?
I was over in that country along the Alaska Peninsula with a geologist, the United States Department of Interior and Standard Oil and Associated Oil and General Petroleum, and we came and went from the village of Kodiak. When I was in Kodiak, there's an old sea captain by the name of McDonald who had a schooner, and he kept telling me about the wonderful grass and the bays and the waterfalls and the ducks and the geese and the swan and the clams and the berries on Sitkalitik Island. And finally, of course, I had to go and look for that island. And they took me with a schooner to the island, and when I saw the island, I was in love with it and have been ever since.
Well, how long did it take you before you finally moved to that island?
Well, I found that my dreams couldn't come true, that this island could not be taken under any land laws that we had at that time. You couldn't lease it, and you couldn't buy it, and of course I wouldn't have had the money to buy it, and couldn't be leased. So when I was in Washington, D.C., I found that it would take an act of Congress in which you could lease islands, either for grazing or for fur farming, and with the help of some of the congressmen in Washington, D.C., we prepared a bill, and after 6 years of time, it passed Congress and was signed by the president. And I'm proud to say that the president gave me the pen that he signed it with, President Coolidge. Mm-hmm. That is 1927, March the 4th, 1927, this bill passed Congress. And I've leased these islands now, and I have Sitkalitik Island, this island that I love so much. I have it leased for 20 years with privilege of extension.
Will you tell us something of your activities out there on the island? I understand that you're increasing your production and also doing some work along the lines of refrigeration.
Well, on Sitkalitik Island, there was nothing, of course, when we leased it. And I say I was in conjunction with a very wonderful pioneer of the States, one that's known in the Northwest more than any other pioneer, I believe, in the cattle business, is Charles H. Fry. He was president and owner of the Fry Packing Company, had many cattle in Montana, and he loved to pioneer, and he loved to do this work with me. So he was president and treasurer of my company until he died. And through him, I was able to get through his stockyards, which he owned in Seattle, breeding stock to propagate and to increase the flocks on this island. So all those cattle and sheep and horses and so forth that are shipped to this island came mostly through his yards. And we always got purebred cattle, and we got Black Angus cattle from Ellensburg district. Instrumental in buying those cattle, who took a great interest in buying at that time, was one of your residents here, Mr. Wechter. That's the Wechter Meat Market. He worked in conjunction with Mr. Fry and getting me the very finest of cattle and sheep.
How many head of cattle do you have out there now?
On this island, we only have about 400. We've used a great many of them during the war period for the Army and Navy. Have about 700 sheep. But we have another island, which is very historic, Chirikoff Island, named after Lieutenant Chirikoff, who was sent out by Catherine the Great to make explorations in the New World. And this island was named for Chirikoff by Vitus Bering, his sailing partner in these explorations. We have this island, and on that island is about, we'll say, 1,200 cattle, which are semi-wild. They're shorthorn cattle, they're just cattle, and they're not as wild as people might think, but they haven't had much attention because they live in and on this island where they don't need attention. They graze the year round and have water and sip salt from the ocean, and during the panic, their meat was worth nothing and the hides not much, so we didn't do much with them. But now that we have a market, we're crossing them with Hereford cattle, Hereford bulls.
Well, that's very interesting to me, and now digressing again during the course of our interview, I'd like to know what you believe to be the most radical change that has taken place in Alaska since you came here. Now, that's a big order.
Well, Al, I don't think it is. I believe that every pioneer would answer you as I am going to. I think we all realize that the biggest change that has affected us in the territory is transportation and means of transportation, roads and airplanes and airfields, and let's say especially airplanes. When we fly over this country and look down on those trails we travel with dog teams that took us all of our provisions and all of our money and everything to get into a far-off country and get there ragged and without food, and when we fly over that same country now and look down on those trails and land in that same country with our breakfast still in our stomachs, we know that we could answer you very quickly and say that that's the greatest change that's taken place in the 40-some years that we've been in this country.
Well, Mr. McCord, I'm sure you'll agree with me that there are many even newer things on the horizon for Alaska, and I think the question of statehood is one which we should all take into consideration. Do you have any views on that particular subject?
Yes, I have, and my views are subject to change, and I can be converted to either side, because this is a very important question. It affects all the people in a very important country at this time. And I believe very much that we're not ready for statehood at this time.
Will you tell us some of the reasons why you believe that we're not ready for statehood?
Alaska is different than any other part of the United States possessions at this time. It's a connecting link between two hemispheres. It's a connecting link between Asia and North America. And on the count of air transportation and on the count of our looking forward to defense and so forth, we're doing great things up in this country. The national government is doing that. The national government is building airports, as you know, in Fairbanks and Anchorage and in Adak and in Kodiak and so forth. Navy and Army are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in these places. They're also dredging the harbors and building lights at sea and weather stations, and they own the railroad and they're building the highways and taking care of the natives and doing all these things that cost a lot of money. And it seems to me, and it doesn't only seem to me, but we know that the territory of Alaska couldn't do these things. And if it was a state tomorrow, it would be in the same position and couldn't carry on this great work that's developing this region and land that connects North America and Asia.
Well, thank you, Mr. McCord. That expression of your opinion is certainly most interesting to me. As a final question, I understand that you are acquainted with quite a number of the world's great and famous. Among them, I believe, is Lowell Thomas and Billy Mitchell and Rex Beach. When did you know Billy Mitchell?
Billy Mitchell came to Alaska in the early days. I didn't know him at that time. And it might be interesting for other pioneers to remember that he built the telegraph line on the Gulf, kind of cut off to Tanano Crossing as a young Army officer. And, of course, we all know in later years of his position in the world and his ideas of airplane flight and so forth. But I became very well acquainted with him about the time the first flyers flew around the world. I became acquainted mostly in Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you, Mr. McCord. You certainly have had a colorful career here in the Northland, and for that reason, I wish I could spend 15 hours rather than 15 minutes in talking over these things with you. But now we'll have to bring to a close this interview with Mr. Jack McCord, member of the Explorers Club and also a prominent Alaskan. Here's a Pioneer is brought to you every Wednesday evening at 7:30 by the Pioneer Cab Company across from the Nordale Hotel. The telephone number is East 10A. Be with us again next Wednesday evening at 7:30 for another interview with one of Alaska's distinguished old-timers. Another Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer, a visit from one of Alaska's real old-timers, a program brought to you every week at this time by your friends, the management and staff of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel. And the telephone number of the old and dependable Pioneer Cab Company is East 10A. This week's guest on Here's a Pioneer is Mr. James A. Seller, who makes his home in Fairbanks. Mr. Seller, suppose you begin your story by telling us when you left home and why.
Well, I was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and I left in 85 and landed in New York. My home was in and around New York until I was about 20, at which time I pulled out for the North, returning with an uncle of mine who had come to the country in 98. And we left New York on the 4th of February, 1901, going direct to Seattle, hence North on the old steamer Victorian to Seattle. From there, we took the train to Whitehorse and were fortunate enough to gain passage on a freighting outfit headed for Dawson over the old CD cutoff.
What kind of a freighting outfit was that?
Well, they were general, just a sled, and they had general merchandise and one thing or another. And we
pulled
were
pulled by dogs or horses?
No, with horses.
Uh-huh.
And we were limited to 40 pounds of baggage.
Just like the airlines.
We were limited, and the charge was $250 apiece. In order to take sufficient clothing along with us, not knowing when the balance would arrive in Dawson, we put on two pair of German socks and two pair of underwear and two shirts and two of everything, including a pair of big rubber boots, and then our package.
So the items of clothing wouldn't be included on your baggage allowance?
No, they weren't allowed. They weren't included on the baggage allowance, so we got away with that part of it.
Now, how many days did you say it took you to make that trip?
We were approximately 2 weeks from the time we left Whitehorse until we arrived in Dawson.
Did you camp out in the open overnight, or did you stay at the
roadhouses? We did in two or three places. Most of the time, we were able to find quarters.
What was the atmosphere of those real early-day roadhouses like? Were the prices high? Was the food good?
Well, you usually got plenty to eat, such as it was. We had plenty of beans and plenty of sourdough hotcakes, plenty of mush.
How much would they charge
fruit
for a meal?
Well, most of them would charge us anywhere from $1.50 to $2 for a meal.
I've heard that some of those early-day roadhouses really took the prize for dishing out the hospitality and the good food.
Well, they did. Some of them had mighty good food, all you wanted to eat.
Uh-huh. Well, that's fine. Now, about your arrival in Dawson, after you got there, where did you settle down and what did you do?
We engaged a cabin over near Moosehide and lived there until the breakup.
Where's Moosehide?
Well, that's the mountain right to the north of Dawson there, right at the north edge.
Then you waited until the breakup.
I waited until the breakup and took the first steamer out, which happened to be the city of Seattle, headed for the Koyukuk.
That's around Wiseman, isn't it?
Yes, that's up around Bettles and Wiseman and Coldfoot.
Any adventures on the way to the Koyukuk country?
Well, we pulled out. Apparently everything was fine and dandy. We started up the Koyukuk and got up about as far as the cutoff and had to turn tail and head back downstream because of a big flow of ice.
You mean you were going upstream and you saw all this ice coming at you?
Coming down, and we had to turn tail and hit the first slough that we could and pulled in until the ice went by, and then we had no further difficulty, and we landed up at Bettles.
You were looking for gold in the Koyukuk country, weren't you?
Oh, yes. I went in with this uncle with the full intention of being a full-fledged miner.
I suppose you became a millionaire in a couple of weeks.
No, it didn't come quite that fast. I know it was plenty of hard work connected with it from 5 in the morning till 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
I suppose if you had all this to do over again, you wouldn't hesitate.
No, I would gladly go over and not miss one measly thing.
Well, tell us what you did when you finally got there and when your first prospecting was over. How did you occupy your time?
Well, I came back down at the close-up. We came back down to Bettles for getting ready to get an outfit for the winter and go back up and live in tents that winter and prospect. But as we pulled in at the bank at Bettles, Volney Richmond, well known to him, a lot of the people in the Fairbanks country here.
Oh, yes.
Was then the manager of the NC Company store at Bettles. He, having come up in the summer of '01 from St. Michael, and took over from Howard Turner, who was then operating for the AC Company.
Alaska Commercial Company.
The Alaska Commercial Company, yeah. And Mr. Richmond was in need of a bookkeeper. So he called me up to the store and asked me if I knew anything about bookkeeping, and I told him that I didn't know any more about it than a rabbit. Well, he told me that it was very simple and very easy, and they had lots of patience, and that if I would only accept the job, they would endeavor to make a bookkeeper out of me. So he finally persuaded me to stay, which I did. I stayed for the winter, and in the spring, my feet began to itch, and I was wanting to get back up on the creeks where I could get that $15 a day. That looked good to me. But he then again used his persuasive powers to keep me where I was. I told him I didn't care about the bookkeeping. It was too confining, that I wanted a little more excitement. I wanted a little more action. Well, he asked me to remain as storekeeper, and that he would raise me $50 a month if I would stay as a storekeeper. Well, I finally decided that I would, and it so happened that I remained then with the NC Company in their employ in various capacities from then until I finally went out in the fall of '15.
I understand that at one time you had some experiences with a boatload of dried fruit. Will you recall that, please?
Oh, that was the old steamer City of Paris that used to haul our freight up into the Bettles country. She had a lot of dried fruit in the hold, and somehow or other a steam pipe broke or something, and it damaged the entire shipment of fruit, and there was quite a number of tons of it. This stuff was unloaded at Bettles, and we had it piled up in the warehouse and made disposition of it. But the joke of the whole thing about the dried fruit was the fact that in 1900 there was a little steamer called the Prospector that came into the Koyukuk, and it was an outfit from Boston that had built this boat and transported it across the continent to Seattle, put it together, and under its own power came on up to St. Michael and hence on up the Yukon and up the Koyukuk and got as far as Peavey. At which point they pulled it up on the bank and put it into winter quarters. They and then went on up the river. In the spring, they came back down to put her in commission and come on further up the river, but found they didn't have any steam pipe. It so happened that all the steam pipe on that little steamer was copper, and the boys found it out. And they, naturally, needed a few coils to run their little tin cans.
Their stills.
Or stills, in other words. So everybody, evidently, had a can in operation.
There's plenty of moonshine in the Koyokuk that year.
Oh, worlds of it. And all shades and colors and strengths and tastes.
Mm. Well, what were the ingredients? That's where you came in.
Well, that's where the dry fruit comes in. The boys would come down and ask us if we had any more of that old damaged dried fruit. It made wonderful dog feed. And we'd say, yes, and we'd go out and sell this one 1,000 or a couple of 1,000 pounds of nectarines or apricots or pears or prunes or whatever it happened to be. And we, knowing very well with the quantity of sugar that he also bought, that it was going through his still.
Well, I understand that the spring of 1905 was a little difficult. Wasn't there a lack of some of the necessities of life?
Well, the staff of life, as it were, in those days, was tobacco and whiskey. Uh-huh. And it so happened that the camp run out of both.